content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the October 2nd, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Pope Francis, politically charged U.S. visit. What happened? Pope Francis began his highly anticipated first visit to the U.S. this week by wading right into politically charged issues, calling for more aggressive action on climate change and pointedly praising the nation's history of welcoming immigrants. Speaking at an elaborate White House ceremony at the outset of a six-day visit, Francis echoed his recent encyclical on the environment by praising President Obama's efforts to combat global warming. "Climate change is a problem which can no longer be left to our future generations," he said. The Pope also called on the U.S. to support the efforts of the international community to protect the vulnerable in our world. His comments delighted liberals but disappointed conservatives, who had feared the pontiff would use the visit to promote his outspoken views on the environment, economic inequality, and immigration. Representative Paul Gosar, a Catholic Republican from Arizona, announced he'd boycott the first ever papal address to Congress, saying, "I don't need to be lectured by the Pope about climate change." But before moving on to New York City and Philadelphia, Francis also delivered a firm defense of the Church's traditional moral teachings, saying the institutions of marriage and family needed to be protected at a critical moment in the history of our civilization. He praised the U.S. for being tolerant and inclusive, but asked that its institutions respect Catholics' right to religious liberty. Before arriving in the U.S., the Pope made a four-day visit to Cuba, where he met with Fidel and Raúl Castro, told Cubans to serve people, not ideas, and hailed the recent diplomatic breakthrough between the two countries that he helped facilitate as an example of reconciliation for the entire world. What the editorial said: "The American Catholic Church badly needs a shot of the Francis effect," said The Economist. "The priest abuse scandals have badly eroded the church's moral authority, and believers are leaving the flock in droves. For every American converted to Catholicism, six abandon it. While communities are growing in the South and West, thanks to the rising Hispanic Catholic population, once preeminent congregations in places like New York and Boston are hollowing out. The church is caught in a major internal split that has become a proxy for America's wider political brawl, with conservative Catholics focused on religious freedom and the rights of the unborn, and liberals concerned with social justice. How ironic it is to see progressives claiming the Pope as an evangelist for their agenda," said the Wall Street Journal. "These opportunists are seizing on the views they like and ignoring the church's teachings on abortion, same-sex marriage, and all of that catechistic unpleasantness. But perhaps the Pope's visit to the land of the free will educate him about the benefits of capitalism. Economic freedom has not only created wealth that has lifted millions out of poverty, it is also, if history is any guide, our best hope of creating the resources to deal with climate change. The Pope may speak for God on matters of faith and morals, but his infallibility does not extend to economics or environmentalism." What the columnist said: "The grinding cinders you hear is Pope John Paul II turning over in his crypt," said Charles Hurt in the Washington Times. Unlike his illustrious predecessor from Poland, who helped President Reagan bring down Soviet communism, Francis is woefully out of his depth on real-world issues. His failure to confront the totalitarian government of Cuba shows he doesn't understand the evils perpetrated by evil, power-hungry men. All popes have their critics, said Donna Brazile in CNN.com. But there is a reason why 74% of Catholics and 63% of all Americans approve of Francis. Francis is the reform pope we need. He has eschewed the grandeur of the official papal quarters at the Vatican, living instead in a modest guest house. And he broke tradition by washing the feet of women, not just men, and bringing in external accountancy firms to clear up the scandal-racked Vatican Bank. He's opened the church's doors to all Catholics, making it easier to have broken marriages annulled and women who've had abortions be absolved of sin. Of gays, he said, "Who am I to judge?" But this pope isn't the liberal rock star American Catholics think he is, said William Salatin in Slate.com. He has carefully avoided challenging the catechism on gay marriage, abortion, and the ordination of women as priests. Francis is offering just enough, procedurally or rhetorically, to lure wayward sheep back into the church. Actually, Francis is far more radical than most Americans, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post. He has no interest in fighting the culture wars over abortion and homosexuality, and preaches the gospel, not the catechism. His only real interest lies in helping the needy, the poor, the outcasts in society. Just look at his itinerary: meeting farm workers and laborers, visiting Philadelphia's largest jail, blessing those helped by Catholic charities. If Francis' uncompromising approach to helping the needy makes him seem like a Marxist, that's because the gospel is radical. What next? Francis will reveal a lot about his intentions when bishops gather in October for the second of two synods on the topic on family, said Emma Green in The Atlantic. In last year's meeting, traditionalists held their ground on such issues as priestly celibacy and the ban on divorced Catholics receiving communion. But in his closing speech, Francis admonished that the church needed to avoid hostile inflexibility to changing the rules. This year's meeting may well yield changes. We'll soon know where Francis wants to take the church, said Ramesh Panuru in National Review. The outcome of this synod will tell us whether he's earnestly inviting the church to engage in open-minded introspection or is a progressive plotter. Before we move on, I wanted to read a short from the It Wasn't All Bad section. Don Pelman is 100 years old and still breaking records. The centenarian athlete, who has competed in 127 track and field meets since retiring from his job with General Electric's subsidiary in 1970, broke five age group world records at this week's San Diego Senior Olympics. He became the first centenarian to clear the bar in the high jump, jumping just shy of 3 feet, and to break 27 seconds in the 100-meter dash. Pelman also set records in the shot put, discus, and long jump. He still wasn't satisfied, though. "This is the worst day I've had in months," Pelman said. "I thought I was in better shape." Our controversy of the week: the clock kid. Does the U.S. have an Islamophobia problem? It was a great week for Islamophobia in America, said Jack Merkinson in Salon.com. First, Ahmed Mohammed, 14, was arrested, handcuffed, and interrogated by police in Irving, Texas, for bringing to school a homemade clock that teachers decided looked like a bomb. That absurd overreaction was later defended by the town's Republican mayor and conservative luminaries such as Rush Limbaugh and Sarah Palin. Then, at a town hall event for Donald Trump, the GOP frontrunner cheerfully promised to look into the concerns of a supporter who called President Obama a foreign-born Muslim, ranted about Islamist training camps, and declared, "We have a problem in this country. It's called Muslims." Finally, on Meet the Press, GOP presidential candidate Ben Carson said that he would absolutely not agree with putting a Muslim in charge of this nation as president. Carson's bigoted view of Muslims is actually a majority sentiment in today's Republican Party, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. As the primaries loom, brace yourself for more nasty appeals to right-wing Islamophobia. Islamophobia is a myth, said Kyle Smith in the New York Post. Since 9/11, liberals have searched in vain for evidence, any evidence, that Muslims are facing deep-seated discrimination, and all they've come up with are non-stories like Ahmed Mohammed's. Ahmed's clock, let the record show, was a scary tangle of wires that looked very much like a bomb, and he chose to bring it to school in a zero-tolerance era in which dozens of students, mostly white Christians, have been suspended or arrested for drawing guns on paper, mentioning guns in homework assignments, or even just wearing National Rifle Association t-shirts. As for Carson, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com, all he said was that he personally wouldn't vote for a Muslim president, not that Muslims should be barred from the office. How is that different from liberals openly scorning candidates with strong Christian beliefs? The truth is that a candidate's faith is deeply relevant, and liberals think so too, when they're not feigning politically correct outrage. Besides, Islam isn't just a religion, said Andrew McCarthy, also in NationalReview.com. It's an entire political social ideology that sets out very clear, strict rules for how people should live their lives. Whether liberals like to admit it or not, Islam is opposed to the separation of church and state, free speech, democracy, and freedom of religion. Carson was right. Islamic ideology is inconsistent with the Constitution. The overwhelming majority of Muslim scholars would disagree with that view of their faith, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. So would nearly all American Muslims who live happily in a secular society. By painting all of Islam as extremist, violent, and inherently un-American, Carson is siding not only with the worst elements of our society, but also with the Islamic extremists themselves. Ben Carson is right about something, though, said Dean Obadallah in thedailybeast.com. Religious extremism is incompatible with democracy and the U.S. Constitution, and that conflict is not purely theoretical. There are several religious extremists running for president this year, all of them Christian. Carson, Mike Huckabee, Rick Santorum, and Ted Cruz all have bitterly complained that the Supreme Court had no right to contradict the biblical definition of marriage, and all insist that Kentucky clerk Kim Davis' religious freedom trumps her duties as a public official. So, in accordance with the Carson Doctrine, all presidential candidates should be asked, "Will you pledge to place our Constitution above the Bible and your religious beliefs?" It will be fascinating to hear their responses. Well, it was a good week for sing-alongs after a federal judge ruled that the song Happy Birthday to You is no longer protected by a 1935 copyright. A California publishing company had raked in $2 million a year enforcing that copyright. It was a good week for A Taste of His Own Medicine after Donald Trump's hashtag AskDonald Twitter feed was overwhelmed by thousands of negative comments about his comb-over and orange skin, as well as such questions as, when you deport all immigrants, where will your Slovenian wife be going? It was a good week for universal confusion after Dutch researchers found that using huh to indicate a lack of understanding is common to 31 vastly different languages, including Muirapatha, spoken by Aboriginal Australians, Icelandic, Hungarian, and Japanese. But it was a bad week for working out after the City Planning Board in exclusive Nantucket, Massachusetts, approved the construction of a new high-end fitness club that requires a $120,000 initiation fee to join. It was a bad week for getting just the right angle after an analysis by Mashable.com revealed that more people worldwide have died this year while taking selfies, 12, than have been killed in shark attacks, 8. And it was a bad week for arachnophobia after an Indiana woman backing out of her driveway jumped out of the moving car when she saw a crawling spider on her shoulder, sending the car crashing into oncoming traffic. I don't think we can charge her with reckless driving, said the local sheriff, because she wasn't in charge of the vehicle. Our briefing page article this week is titled A History of Populism. Maverick candidates Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump carry on a long-standing American tradition. What is populism? Broadly speaking, it's the belief that the will of ordinary citizens should prevail over that of a privileged elite. Throughout American history, movements based on anti-elitism have repeatedly sprung up on both the left and right, often stoked by charismatic firebrands who harnessed the resentment of marginalized people. Today, both the Democratic and Republican parties have been splintered by populist movements. Bernie Sanders, a self-described democratic socialist who rails against income inequality and the billionaire class, is mounting a serious challenge to Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton. The Republican race, meanwhile, has been roiled by the right-wing populist campaign of real estate mogul Donald Trump, who vows to deport all 11.5 million illegal immigrants and build a massive wall at the Mexican border. Neither Sanders nor Trump's message is really new. Sanders has picked up where the late 19th century populist party left off, and as former Texas Governor Rick Perry recently observed, Donald Trump is the modern-day incarnation of the Know-Nothing movement. Who were the Know-Nothings? They were a xenophobic political movement that arose in the 1840s in reaction to a huge influx of Irish, Catholic, and German immigrants. Native-born Protestants saw these immigrants as job-stealing threats to America's cultural and religious identity. The Know-Nothings began as secret societies. Asked about their ties to these groups, members were instructed to say they knew nothing. But they came out of the closet in 1855 to form the American Party, demanding immigration restrictions and a 21-year residency requirement for citizenship. In 1856, the Know-Nothings chose former President Millard Fillmore as their nominee, and he won 21.6% of the vote. Later, a rift between anti-slavery and pro-slavery factions fatally splintered their movement. But nativism has flared anew with every successive wave of immigration. What about left-wing populism? The first movement of this kind was started in the 1880s by farmers who were suffering because of plummeting cotton prices in the South and a drought in the Great Plains. As farmers sank deeper into debt, their simmering resentments of Eastern elites were ignited, especially by bankers charging exorbitant lending rates and railroad barons charging high prices. The farmers, labor unions, and their sympathizers formed what they officially called the People's Party, but was commonly known as the Populists. The Populists felt squeezed by the unfettered capitalism of the Gilded Age, said Rutgers University historian David Greenberg. The Populists wanted to nationalize railroads, break up big trusts, and get rid of the gold standard, which restricted the money supply. They also advocated an 8-hour workday, women's suffrage, and a progressive income tax. In 1892, Populist presidential candidate James B. Weaver won 8.5% of the vote, but it was downhill from there. What happened? The Populists split into two factions: fusionists, who thought the party should merge with the Democrats, and populists, who preferred independence. The fusionists prevailed, rallying behind 1896 Democratic presidential candidate William Jennings Bryan, whose convention address decrying the gold standard, "You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold," remains one of American history's most famous speeches. He lost the election to Republican William McKinley, however, and went on to lose two more. But Bryan left a lasting populist legacy. He was the first leader of a major party to argue for permanently expanding the power of the federal government to serve the welfare of ordinary Americans, said biographer Michael Kazin. What became of the populists? Many of their core ideas were absorbed by the Democratic Party and became the foundation of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal. More radical versions also sprang up during the Depression, which saw the meteoric rise of Huey P. Long. But during the Cold War, anti-elitism began to slip its liberal moorings, Kazin says. After controlling federal power for a generation, liberals were the elite, and populism took a hard right turn. The anti-communist crusade of Senator Joseph McCarthy trained its rhetoric mostly on left-leaning academics, Ivy League-educated officials, and Hollywood actors and producers. In the 1960s, segregationist Alabama Governor George Wallace played the working-class hero, snarling at pointy-headed bureaucrats and liberals. His third-party presidential bid in 1968 drew 13.6% of the vote. Conservatism has had a strain of anti-elite populism ever since, most recently and effectively in the Tea Party. Why has populism returned? The 2008 financial crisis sparked an explosion of anger against Wall Street and Washington. In Sanders, left-wing populism comes full circle. His stump speeches would have played well in the 1890s. Trump has taken the old nativist message, added a big dose of narcissism, and turned his movement into a cult of personality. But throughout history, populists from left to right have had something in common besides anti-elitism. While they often influence mainstream parties, they don't win national elections. The majority of voters reject their use versus them mentality, said columnist David Brooks, making the history of populism generally a history of defeat. On to the columns now. We'll take two from the U.S. The first: did W really keep America safe? During last week's Republican debate, Jeb Bush made a curious claim, said Jonathan Chait. His brother, George W., had kept us safe, he proclaimed, to loud applause from a Republican audience. But Jeb neglected to mention that the worst domestic mass casualty attack in American history took place on his brother's watch, with 3,000 people killed and the World Trade Center reduced to rubble. Even worse, W received multiple CIA warnings of an impending al-Qaeda attack and did nothing. The CIA told the Bush administration that a group presently in the U.S. was planning a major terrorist operation soon. On August 6, while Bush was on vacation, he was handed a memo headlined, "Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S." Bush and his aides dismissed the urgent warnings as a disinformation campaign to distract attention from the real threat, Iraq. After 9/11, Bush let Osama bin Laden get away at Tora Bora and then led the country into the Iraq War, which was not exactly a safety-enhancing event either. But Bush sure did talk tough. Only in some alternative reality did his stuttering displays of alpha manhood make America safer. Hillary's hypocrisy on sexual assault. Hillary Clinton told an interviewer last week that women who report sexual assaults must be heard and believed, or they'll be pressured to remain silent. "Now there's a fascinating switch," said Sean Davis. During the 1980s and 90s, Hillary's response to the many women who accused her husband, Bill, of sexual assault was that they should be immediately slimed and shamed. Hillary and Bill's inner circle orchestrated campaigns to destroy the reputations of at least three women who accused Bill of assaulting them: Kathleen Willey, Juanita Broderick, and Paula Jones. Willie, a one-time Clinton campaign organizer who says Bill groped her in a 1993 Oval Office meeting, later blamed Hillary for enabling her husband's predatory behavior and seeking to ruin women who dared to speak out about it. When Jones sued Bill for allegedly exposing himself to her, Team Clinton smeared her as trailer trash out to make some money. Hillary also called Jennifer Flowers, Clinton's longtime mistress, a liar, and Monica Lewinsky a narcissistic Looney Tune. But maybe Hillary has had a sincere change of heart. If so, does she now believe her husband's many accusers? This column from China. The return of warmongering Japan. "A nightmare scenario has never been closer," said Xinhua News Agency. Despite the opposition of many Japanese, the country's parliament has voted to allow Japan's military to fight overseas for the first time since the end of World War II. China is understandably horrified by Japan's decision to jettison its pacifist constitution, which has served the region well for 70 years. And yet Japan has done nothing to assuage Chinese alarm. In fact, it has already begun to glorify its belligerent past. Can it be a coincidence that the vote was held on September 18th, the 84th anniversary of the Japanese invasion of China? Has Japan really forgotten the ensuing 14-year war that left more than 35 million Chinese dead or wounded? The timing seems particularly deliberate, given that just a few months ago, Japan named a large helicopter-capable Navy ship after one of the vessels used in the invasion. Another ship was named after one of the six aircraft carriers that attacked Pearl Harbor, bringing the U.S. into World War II. If Japan has no aggressive intentions, why would it name its new ships after vessels that started wars of aggression in the past? Does Japan intend to challenge the international order? And our in-depth article this week, it's titled "Losing Sight of the Stars." "Light pollution is ruining our view of the night sky," said Todd Pittock. "One astronomer hopes to change that." "If you see a car along that road," Tyler Nordgren warned me, Don't look at the headlights. It'll ruin your night vision for 2 hours. Nordgren and I had pitched our tents under the brow of Mount Whitney in the Alabama Hills, a field of boulders near Death Valley. We watched it get dark, and in the nighttime horizon, the sky was perforated by stars and streaked by the Milky Way. Or to put it in approximate scientific terms, it was probably a 3 on the Bortle scale, the 9-level numeric metric of night sky brightness. Even so, we could still see domes of hazy light from 200-odd miles south in Los Angeles and 250 miles east in Las Vegas. That encroaching urban glow was like highlighter calling attention to the issue that Nordgren, a prophet whose cause is light pollution, wanted to illustrate for me. "We're losing the stars," the 45-year-old astronomer told me. "Think about it this way. For 4.5 billion years, Earth has been a planet with a day and a night. Since the electric light bulb was invented, we've progressively lit up the night and have gotten rid of it. Now 99% of the population lives under skies filled with light pollution." Nordgren is an affable, engaging, and quotable Cassandra, an enthusiastic and patient teacher who loves his subject and wants you to love it too. These attributes, along with a book for a lay audience, Stars Above, Earth Below, A Guide to Astronomy in the National Parks, have pushed him to the center stage in a small but impassioned movement to preserve natural night skies. When he is not lecturing at the University of Redlands, a California liberal arts college, Nordgren is a much sought-after itinerant preacher intent on bringing people a revelation of the stars they have, almost everywhere, lost sight of. Almost the entire eastern half of the United States, the West Coast, and almost every place with an airport large enough to receive commercial jets are too lit up for a good view of the stars. The phenomenon was illustrated by the First World Atlas of Artificial Night Sky Brightness. Based on spacecraft images of Earth in 1997, it shows a spectrum from black, representing the natural night sky, to pink, in which artificial light effectively erases any view of the stars at all. Green is where you lose visibility of the Milky Way. The map of the contiguous 48 states and much of Europe looks like a video game screen showing a carpet bombing, the map a splash of green, yellow, red, and pink. For roughly the past two decades, at least two-thirds of the U.S. population has not been able to see the Milky Way at all. And it will get worse before it gets better. The dawn of light-emitting diode LED lighting is expected to significantly lower cost and spur consumption. In addition, LED lighting produces light with a bluer cast, which is more effectively scattered by the atmosphere. This has the potential to be the nail in the coffin for seeing stars in most communities, Nordgren tells me. Nordgren wears his hair in the style of a naval officer, cropped on the sides, and I sense that he probably looks much like the boy he once was, who had his sights on becoming an astronaut. Poor vision forced him to settle on becoming a mere astronomer. He wrote his doctoral thesis at Cornell University on dark matter in spiral galaxies, graduating in 1997. Carl Sagan, whose popular TV series Cosmos had inspired Nordgren to begin with, was there at the time, and Nordgren still regrets that whenever he was in the presence of his idol, he would lose his capacity for speech. He couldn't even find the courage to introduce himself, and when he finally did, Sagan said, "I know who you are." The light pollution issue first came up in 1992, when Nordgren went to the California Institute of Technology's Palomar Observatory near San Diego. At the time, Palomar had the world's largest telescope. Already, though, the night glow from the surrounding area was forcing astronomers to go elsewhere. In 2005, I went back to Palomar to do some work on adaptive optics, looking at storm clouds moving atop Uranus and Neptune, And it was really a shock, Nordgren recalled. Giant housing, casinos, resorts. In 92, you were like, look how bad this is. Then in 05, we were just an island in a sea of lights. Light pollution was threatening to bring down the curtain on future research for astronomers, Nordgren said, making existing observatories useless and efforts to build new ones in the U.S. more difficult, as they had to be built in places that put astronomers in conflict with environmentalists and Native Americans. The light pollution problem grew significantly during the period that was, courtesy of the Hubble Space Telescope, a golden age in astronomy. Hubble went into orbit in 1990 and sent back images of space, unencumbered by backlighting, that would have made Galileo's head spin. But Hubble, despite its marvels, somewhat confused the issue, leading people to assume that astronomy would proceed apace even if astronomers were being shown to obstructed view seats. The trouble is that Hubble isn't sustainable. Its costs are, as it were, astronomical. It requires space shuttle missions to maintain, and there are no more of those. So Hubble will be gone in a few years. The next project to replace it is over budget and far behind schedule. The long-term solution will rely on terrestrial observations. Finding places to put these, though, isn't easy. As astronomers lose the functionality of existing observations to light pollution and move to places like Mount Graham in Arizona and Mauna Kea, the location of the W.M. Keck Observatory in Hawaii, they've been protested, sued, and made feel like wanton intruders, wreckers of the environment, and defilers of sacred spaces. Really ambitious observatory projects, therefore, look overseas. When the Square Kilometer Array Telescope came up for bidding, a process like hosting the Olympics, the U.S. wasn't in the race. Foreign observatories bring with them concerns about long-term political stability. The question of light pollution gripped Nordgren. Like Sagan, he decided that educating the public was key. When he got his first sabbatical in 2007-08, he decided he'd spend the time normally reserved for lab work and writing to travel to national parks to give talks. He knew from experience that visitors to the national parks want to reconnect to the stars above. But almost all national park programs were about things on the land. He wanted to remind visitors that the parks, as the last preserves of natural light, of natural night, were also about the skies. He devoted 3 weeks to each of a dozen places, among them Rocky Mountain National Park, the Grand Tetons, Glacier, Acadia, and Great Basin. There were some who had no idea what to make of what I was doing, he said. I remember folks in the Great Smoky Mountains. When I said I wanted to work with astronomy in the night skies, the ranger said, "We call it the Great Smokies. We don't do a lot of astronomy here." He was baffled, and then I'd run into people in management for whom it was a 9-to-5 job. When it got dark, they went home, so they never saw firsthand the night sky programs, and this was 2007-08, when budgets were very tight. In addition to his night skies curriculum, Nordgren created an arts program. See the Milky Way. It's gone on for 5 years with poster designs for 30 parks, monuments, and dark skies preserves. The National Parks Odyssey also resulted in Stars Above, Earth Below, his guidebook, which, though it sold out of a relatively modest 3,000 copy first print run and sells now through print on demand, found an enduring and loyal audience among rangers. One of them was Kelly Carroll, a National Park Service ranger at Great Basin. He invited Nordgren to keynote the annual astronomy festival he'd organized and was immediately won over. Every once in a while, a scientist comes along who knows how to speak about science to the general public, Carroll told me. Tyler has a way of speaking about light pollution and the aesthetics of the issue. He helps make the connection of what it means to us to lose the night skies as human beings. Carol, who was a geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey prior to joining the Park Service, told me that the need for someone like Nordgren is great. People are barely aware that we've had an incredible part of our humanity taken away from us, but it's been so gradual, they don't feel the loss, he said. Rangers tell Nordgren that the night programs get more attendance than all other programs put together. One great success story is Great Basin National Park, which in 2009 put on three night skies programs that drew 300 people. The following year, they did 20, which were well attended, so they instituted night skies as a primary offering. Since then, overnight park stays have increased to about 9,000 a year. The first time people come out for a dark skies, and we get Bortle Class 1 and 2 here, it affects them deeply, Carol said. They're blown away. The connection with the stars is inside all of us, but it has been sequestered away. Christian Lugenbull, an astronomer who worked with Nordgren at the Naval Observatory Flagstaff Station, explained to me that Nordgren helps participants understand the cultural value of the nighttime sky. It's also one thing all of humanity has in common, he tells me. It's the same sky in the Sahara as it is over Philadelphia. It's also the same sky as Native Americans gazed up at 10,000 years ago. People think of light pollution as an astronomer's concern, but Tyler helps establish this broad value that it matters to everyone. I trained my eyes straight upward to the zenith and settled in as Nordgren used a laser pointer to explain what we could see in the night sky. Giant clouds of interstellar dust and plumes of vaporized debris, some the size of the Earth. He talked about the surface of Titan, a moon of Saturn with Earth-like features, where under a smoggy orange layer it all looks like Minnesota's land of 10,000 lakes, with fractal shores and frozen methane raining out of the sky. We spent some time taking photographs, fiddling with camera settings, a lesson in shooting in the dark to augment my brief alfresco astronomy class. Over the past decade, there has been a revolution in photography, Nordgren told me. Everyone has a camera now. In the 1950s, Ansel Adams went to photograph the national parks. Some feel that started the modern environmental movement. We're there again. People are so stunned when they see the night sky photos, they think they're fake. Maybe this will be the impetus of a night sky environmental movement. After a cold but pleasant night by Mount Whitney, the view near dawn was splendid. The pale blue night above brightening to a spray of colors on the horizon. It wasn't, though, the sunrise I took it to be. It was zodiacal light, or false dawn. The beauty of a life in astronomy, at least as it's explained by Nordgren, is that every moment, it seems, is a phenomenon described in a way that's both precise and lovely. What you're seeing, Nordgren said, is that in the plane of our solar system, the disk of the planets orbit the sun in, there are grains of dust that float in there, in the same plane. Those grains of dust reflect and scatter sunlight. It's exactly like the sunbeam you'd seen in your house. Morning glory. The stars are still out there, Nordgren told me. They're just waiting for us to pay attention again. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in nautil.us. We're going to read one of the business columns this week. Autos, Volkswagen's clean diesel scandal. It sounds like the sinister plot of some straight-to-DVD movie, said Brad Plummer in Vox.com. For years, Volkswagen has been installing elaborate software in millions of its so-called clean diesel cars in order to cheat on emissions tests. When that computer code detected certain steering and pedal movements that suggested a car was being tested in a lab, it turned the vehicle's pollution controls on. But outside the lab, the car spewed up to 40 times the legal amount of smog-forming nitrogen oxide, which can contribute to respiratory problems such as asthma and emphysema. When an independent clean transport group spotted a discrepancy between VW's lab and road results last year, regulators began grilling the automaker's executives and engineers. After repeated denials, Volkswagen finally admitted this week that defeat devices had indeed been installed in its cars. I am endlessly sorry, said CEO Martin Winterkorn before resigning. The Environmental Protection Agency has ordered VW to recall all of the 482,000 diesel cars it has sold in the U.S. since 2009, including Golf, Passat, and Jetta models, and to fix the vehicle's emission systems. The company also faces up to $18 billion in fines under the Clean Air Act, as well as possible criminal charges, news that prompted VW stock to plunge 20% in a single day. Americans should be outraged by VW's cynical and deliberate efforts to violate U.S. law, said the Los Angeles Times in an editorial. Clean diesel cars are marketed as offering great mileage and low pollution. But the challenge is that emissions controls degrade a car's engine more quickly and slow it down, taking away a bit of the zip that VW likes to advertise and that helps sell cars. It appears that when VW couldn't get the right mix of speed, fuel economy, and cleanliness, it simply decided to paper over its engineering problems with calculated cheating. Intentionally deceiving regulators and governments is one of the most serious things any company can do, said John Gapper in the Financial Times, and this scandal would be devastating for VW's brand and its bottom line. The company, which this year surpassed Toyota as the world's biggest automaker, has already set aside more than $7 billion, about half a year's profits, to cover the cost of fixes and fines. Perhaps worse, the cheating has seriously tarnished the reputation of diesel-powered cars, which VW has pushed heavily in the U.S. and which are a cornerstone of its European sales. Given the lax auto testing regime in the U.S., there is a good chance that VW isn't the sole scofflaw, said Edward Niedermeyer in BloombergView.com. The EPA gives automakers wide latitude to test their own vehicles for fuel efficiency and emissions compliance, and the agency conducts spot checks on just 10 to 15% of all models. It is, in many ways, an invitation to corner cutting and outright cheating. VW has given car shoppers everywhere a wake-up call, said Ezra Dyer in PopularMechanics.com. So next time you see a vehicle advertised as having great fuel economy, tons of torque, and a bargain price, just remember, when something seems a little too good to be true, maybe that's because it is. On the health and science page, a daily aspirin to prevent cancer. An influential task force of medical experts has sparked controversy by recommending that adults over 50 take a daily low-dose aspirin to prevent both heart attacks and colorectal cancer. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, appointed by the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, said its extensive review of data found that adults who are at increased risk of cardiovascular disease could benefit from daily aspirin use, even if they have not had previous heart problems. One study found a 22% reduction in heart attacks. A daily low-dose aspirin taken over 10 years also lowers the risk of colon cancer by up to 40%, the panel said. Many doctors, however, oppose daily aspirin for people with no prior history of heart disease on the ground that its drug's anti-clotting effects can cause bleeding in the stomach, intestines, and brain, and possibly lead to strokes. But the task force, whose recommendation will have strong influence on the medical community, said the benefits of low-dose aspirin outweigh the risks, especially for people in their 50s with signs of heart disease or a history of heart attacks. Dr. Douglas Owens, a Stanford University professor and task force member, told CBSNews.com that the recommendation does not mean that people should take aspirin without consulting their doctor. If you're a person trying to decide whether to take aspirin, you'd want to be aware of all the potential benefits and the potential harms, Owens says. Moving on to the talking points page, the GOP. Fiorina's up, Walker's out, and Trump's losing steam. And the race is on, said Tammy Bruce in the WashingtonTimes.com. After the bizarre summer of Trump, the Republicans' 2016 presidential campaign is finally beginning to take a serious shape amid the fallout of last week's second GOP presidential debate. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, once a leading candidate, was forced to drop out of the race after completely failing to make an impact. Former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina, meanwhile, has surged into second place in the polls on the back of a commanding debate performance in which she wounded bombastic frontrunner Donald Trump, who has dropped 8 points in the latest CNN poll. Establishment favorites Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio also managed to land some punches on Trump, said John Fund in NationalReview.com. But it was Fiorina who stole the show. The former business executive was feisty but poised, speaking eloquently about Planned Parenthood's use of fetal tissue from abortions and the flawed nuclear deal with Iran. Her biggest moment came at Trump's expense when she was asked about his recent nasty remark about her face. I think women all over this country heard very clearly what Mr. Trump said, Fiorina coolly replied to wild applause. It was a soundbite perfect response and made Fiorina the winner of the night. Fiorina should enjoy her success now, said John Hawkins in townhall.com, because when the media focuses on her record as CEO, she's toast. Fact is, Fiorina was a disaster for Hewlett-Packard. During her tumultuous tenure, she insisted on a short-sighted merger with Compaq. The company's stock plunged more than 60% as a result, and Fiorina laid off 30,000 employees before walking off into the sunset with a $21 million golden parachute. Many business writers rate her as one of the worst CEOs of all time. Still, Fiorina's gender and steely manner make her a tempting prospect for conservatives, said Carol Markowitz in Time.com, since she can freely attack Hillary Clinton without being accused of sexism. She'd look pretty good to them as the number two on the ticket. If it's possible to have a runaway favorite for vice president, then Carly Fiorina is it. But do Republicans even care about winning the general election, asked Philip Rucker in WashingtonPost.com. The economy is the top issue for all voters, and yet during the 3 hours of the GOP debate, the various candidates focused almost exclusively on national security, abortion, and immigration in dark, sometimes apocalyptic tones, with barely a mention for middle-class economic growth. Listen to the candidates' strained attempts to throw red meat to the conservative base was surreal, said the New York Times in an editorial. It was as if Trump, Fiorina, Bush, Rubio, Ben Carson, Ted Cruz, and the rest were no longer living in a fact-based world where actions have consequences. Trump spoke blithely about the mass expulsion of 11 million unauthorized immigrants. Rubio, once an immigration moderate, endorsed a 2,000-mile-long fence at the Mexican border, while Carson insisted on a double fence. This is supposedly the Republicans' A-team, as Mike Huckabee put it, and that, America, is frightening. But there's a consolation. Trump may be losing his luster, said Ryan Leza in NewYorker.com. The real estate mogul generated enormous attention at the onset of this campaign by pledging to make America great again. But after offering nothing but entertaining bromides and insults in the first act of the Trump show, he showed last week he has absolutely no plan for the second act. He had no substantive answers to standard policy questions, particularly on foreign affairs. And by the end of the 3 hours, he looked bored, uncomfortable, and deflated. Trump won't lose his supporters overnight, but his poll lead is shrinking, and the curtain may come down soon. When it does, the party will begin looking to unite behind a candidate who can win in 2016, said Dylan Matthews in Vox.com. With Walker gone, Rubio is the only other solid conservative with a serious claim to electability. The Florida senator has been biding his time, while the establishment moderate Bush has withered under Trump's vicious put-downs. When called on in the debates, Rubio has offered passionate, substantive, and extremely conservative responses. And it's Rubio, above anyone, that Democrats fear the most. He's young, charismatic, and best of all, he's Latino, which will help Republicans undo the damage wrought by Trump's anti-immigration onslaught. Rubio still has a lot to prove, but he is now the dark horse, and there are worse horses on which to bet. And speaking of the debate, the Poll Watch says that 52% of Republicans who watched the second GOP debate said that Carly Fiorina was the winner. Marco Rubio came in second with 14%. 31% thought Donald Trump did the worst of any candidate. And we'll finish up today with a quote from George Bernard Shaw. The single biggest problem in communication is the illusion that it has taken place. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments, give us a call, 919-832-5138.